Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. Seats.
Three seats.
No takers. Maybe it's cooler back there. Maybe it's just the sense that they can flee. all right, so I thought I'd talk tonight about that feeling that sometimes can arise in life of being broken or damaged or unrepairable. I was asked to speak at a meeting this weekend, and it's sort of a topic that I began to address, and it's one that I hear, and I think it's an interesting topic to explore a little bit. Often what causes this feeling that there's some part of us that, or maybe it can be the entirety. Sometimes people feel just entirely broken. Yeah, by which I don't mean physically, we're talking mentally here. Sometimes that feeling of being damaged can be isolated to a specific area of our lives. For example, we can feel that we're doing okay in our jobs, but we can feel like our relationship picker is broken. Or the way we relate to our families is damaged beyond repair. Or we can feel that perhaps we feel that we have a good relationship, but we're frustrated with, we feel we're self-sabotaging in our creative endeavors or in our music and our art, or we can feel, sometimes it's the feeling that our careers or our work is completely unsatisfactory, and we feel that there's just something that's unfixable in the way we approach it. So what often leads to this feeling of being, of there being elements in our life that are damaged or broken is, first of all, the sense that I'm falling into self-destructive behaviors even though I know better. I have the awareness that every time I get lonely and I call up that number on the phone, the next day I'll feel miserable, but still people do it. They sleep with somebody who doesn't make them feel good about themselves, or they call up friends that are not giving them compassion. We reach for love from family members who are not giving it to us. Again and again and again, even though we know better, we fall into these patterns. Sometimes they're addictive. Consuming food or shopping, before we know it, we're buying something when we feel frustrated with our jobs and our careers. Or when we feel lonely, maybe we eat. Or when we feel isolated. Or we take an action that feels good in the short term, but in the long term brings about a sense of low self-esteem and a sense of being not in control, because we know that afterwards we don't feel good about it. Another element that makes this feel like we're broken is not only that we do it despite knowing better, is that often it happens in the blink of an eye. Sometimes, before we know it, we can, or almost it seems like unconsciously, we can fall into a habit. Sometimes people say they found themselves drinking, or they found themselves stealing something, or some people are addicted to shoplifting, or buying, purchasing things, even though they know they don't have the money or the need for whatever they're purchasing. But it can have this automatic quality of, one moment I was doing great, and the next moment I was at, the donut store. I don't know what happened. I was outside one moment, the next moment it was in my mouth, the donut. The donut has powers. And also sometimes just the urges that are pushing us towards these self-destructive behaviors can feel so strong. It can feel like there's this dark, self-destructive entity in us. Like there's this demon or this darkness or this thing that wants to sabotage us. And we can paint these pictures of it having this entire personality. I've spoken at many, many drug detoxes and rehabs over the years, and people almost invariably personalize their addiction as this evil demon on their shoulders that they wish they could beat up, as if adding anger and self-hate into the mix is going to help. But so as the Buddha taught, in order to work with these feelings, we first have to understand where this mechanism in our lives comes from, and then the solutions become readily apparent. Now, the forces that push us towards self-destructive behaviors are stress. Stress comes in a variety of components, but primarily it's physical, which we're often unaware of, and it's simply the body tightness that we carry from being overscheduled, from being filled up with plans and obligations and all the stuff that we carry around. We tend to be so unaware of the body, carrying around so much stuff in our heads, that the body, knowing we're not keeping track of it, we're not looking after it, we're not making sure that it's taken care of, it begins to take on a very armored, tense shell. Additionally, all the times we get agitated and bent out of shape by any little incident that threatens our sense of control, the body becomes tense, and it maintains that tension unless we purposely relax it. So we tend to, over the course of our stressful lives, our busy lives, build up so much underlying stress that we're unaware of, that we're carrying around physically. And this creates already a very sort of tense environment. And then what happens is we add all these obligations and responsibilities, and something comes along, and it becomes the straw that broke the camel's back. It becomes too much. Sometimes we don't understand why that one little remark or that one little thing that somebody asks us to do suddenly sets us off. It's because we're already carrying around, physically and unconsciously, so many expectations of ourselves, so many responsibilities, so many goals we have to meet. Some people have themselves scheduled far off into the future. At one point in our life, often very young, we develop these techniques that make occasionally all these stresses go away like that. These are called coping strategies. They seem like they're externally focused, but actually they're generally internally about removing the entire feeling of being overwhelmed, out of control, stressed out. When we're kids, it's stomping our feet, lying, throwing a tantrum, running away and hiding when we've done something wrong, exaggerating to get attention from people. And these coping strategies get rid of the stress of feeling alone and not taken care of or not acknowledged and seen by a parent, and they instead replace it with the feeling of, yes, I'm seen, I'm acknowledged, people love me, they're aware of what, they're taking care of me, they know what I'm going through. So it's an immediate relief. In the long term, unfortunately, the strategies of stomping our feet, lying, exaggerating, hiding, they don't work. Usually they don't work. When we grow older, these coping strategies turn into self-sabotaging events. Then later on in life, we develop other sets of more, maybe often in teenage years, we develop the techniques of numbing ourselves when we feel shame or uncomfortable, going to a high school dance or on a date or in interpersonal socialization, we might feel something's amiss. So we drink, or we get high, or we might take on certain personas to try to get. And again, we're trying to get rid of the stress as quickly as possible, numbing ourselves. So all of these strategies start out as ways to get rid of stress. It's important to realize that. And they work at one point, and then they stop working. When we, in the short term, get rid of stress, not only does the cortisol stop releasing that makes us feel uncomfortable, but also the brain rewards us with dopamine. So not only do we feel a sense of, I got out of that, but the brain is flooded with reward chemicals. Yes, you. This is great. You stumbled upon it. Weed is terrific. This is it. Beer is awesome. Sex is the answer to everything. I just want to buy stuff forever. Then I'll never feel loneliness. Then I'll never feel criticized, abandoned, rejected. If only I could just go back again and again and get that feeling. So the key thing to realize is that in these coping strategies that in adult life become self-sabotaging, they started out as attempts to, not even attempts, they worked for a while, for a brief period. Each of our coping strategies worked and relieved us of stress and suffering momentarily. And so rather than being this dark demon in us that is trying to kill us, there is no darkness in us that wants to kill us. Every single coping strategy, every single addiction we have started out as an attempt to end our stress and suffering. This is why the Buddha doesn't refer to our addictions, anusayas, he called them, as bad or evil or darkness. He described them as unskillful, akusala. He viewed every single unsuccessful behavior we have as a strategy for happiness that went awry. Something that we've brought from one point in our life when it briefly worked and we didn't see the long-term results. We've stuck to it, and we've, through denial often, or through simply by repetition, we've ingrained these actions deep into the cingulate, the part of the brain, I'm sorry, the striatum, the part of the brain that gives us habitual responses. When we repeat actions, they become hard-ridden, neurons that fire together, wire together. So what started out as a choice or something we stumble upon becomes now an ingrained circuitry. The moment we feel stress in a certain part of our lives, we go for the stress relief. One of my favorite examples of this is people who can't write papers, can't write something that they have to write. And I have a whole bunch of friends that have this, and they all say, I don't know what it is. I sit down, I carve out a period of time, and the next thing I know, I've been on the web downloading movies for 4 hours. What happened? Well, what happens is, You sit down, the feelings of you're not being, you're going to fail or whatever, add into already all the stress that you associate with writing a paper, and immediately the thing that started out as a relief, diverting your attention to buying something or accumulating something or distracting yourself, kicks in. It's not an attempt to ruin your life. It's simply an ingrained way that the mind has of trying to relieve you from suffering. So when we make this very important understanding that what feels like it's broken is actually something that's trying to take care of ourselves, like a little six-year-old that thinks the way to deal with every criticism is to run away or get angry or to shout or to avoid that person forever when something goes awry. Instead, what we do is we learn to turn towards these urges and we learn to acknowledge them. We learn to see them. The first key in all of this process is, of course, throughout the course of the day, whenever we're about to do anything that causes stress or raises the stress level, anything we associate in our past with any sense of failure or rejection or abandonment, is to scan the body and relax it. Look for the areas that carry tension, the jaw, the chest, the belly, and relax it. Find the breath and make it full and even and smooth rather than short and staccato, which makes us anxious. Now the second part is then, after we've relaxed the body, see if I got my, yes, then we want to determine if our urges are skillful or not. So rather than acting out on the first idea that comes about when we're feeling tense, what we can do is instead wait for a second, pause, and see, how does this idea, this urge, how does it affect my body and my breath? Now that I've got the breath relaxed, when I think about calling this person up or going on the internet and shopping instead of writing this paper or buying these shoes instead of paying my bills, how does this feel in the body? At first it might feel like a great idea, but very often when we watch it, we begin to see that a subtle tension arises. A second thing that really works when I've got these urges is to see if they're accompanied by self-justification. In my experience, good, skillful ideas don't come with a lot of verbiage in my mind. They don't come with a self-justification list of, yes, I'm going to blow off doing this thing that I've been avoiding because I really fucking don't want to deal with it, and anyway I feel put upon, and fuck you, and anyway. When there's all this underlying language, what the Buddha called kriya, or agitation, it's a sign that something's amiss. When we're doing something that we will feel is skillful, there's generally not a lot of self-justification. Another way to notice is the unskillful urges tend to be very loud and very repetitive. The Buddha often described the mind as being like a committee. Like a committee, it's got Republicans and it's got progressives, it's got centrists in there, conservatives. The conservatives are loud and they're screaming that you're gonna die unless you follow their advice. And they're threatening you. And you look for those urges in your mind, the ones that say, I'm gonna die out of loneliness. I'll never have sex again unless I call up this number or go to this bar, or I'll never be happy again unless I do this. anything that threatens you or says that your future is fucked or belittles you, that's not a voice you want to listen to. Any voice that tells you something that you wouldn't tell to somebody you loved is a voice you don't give your full, undivided attention towards. Any voice that you wouldn't feel proud being the last thought in your mind. This is another way I look at it. One of my teachers, a monk, said, if you can't imagine the Buddha having said it to you, sort of like that, what would Jesus do? I guess. But, you know, can you really imagine a wise spiritual person telling you, okay, you got those bills over there that you haven't opened up. Wouldn't it be a better idea if you went on Amazon and shopped for DVDs? Is that something I could imagine the Buddha saying to me? Or Ajahn Jeff? No, I can't really imagine it. The next thing is, once we've acted out on something, the tendency is, when we feel shame, to try to eradicate it by doing the worst thing possible, which is beating ourselves up afterwards. I can't believe I did this. I'm such an idiot. I'm going to call up my friends and tell them what a schmuck I am. Can you believe it? I said last night I wasn't going to, you know, eat those five whatevers, and I did it again. The adding on all this sense of shame, all this sense of there's something about me that's unique, this does not reduce stress. This does not relieve the underlying conditions that drive us towards, you know, stress relief. What does is feeling a sense of, first of all, acknowledgement and compassion. Okay, I was stressed out. I took a way that's not going to relieve my stress for the long term. I undertook a method that I can see was trying to bring me peace, but it's not brought me lasting peace. And just see that. Just see that this action clearly is not bringing you relief. And just feel that feeling. That feeling of what the Buddha called samvega, which is, I deserve better. I deserve to find strategies that work. It's just a feeling of, I deserve to be happy, and this is not making me happy. That's all we need. The rest, the shaming that gives us the illusion that we're doing something about it, if we beat up on ourselves, especially publicly, by calling up our friends and shaming ourselves, that in fact does the opposite. It entrenches the self-sabotaging behaviors even deeper. Finally, there's the important technique of learning to implant skillful voices, skillful techniques, skillful behaviors that do reduce suffering. The first technique, the Buddha said, is to focus on right now, today. What is it I can do to bring comfort to myself that I've seen in the past makes me feel good in the long term? I'm not going to try to fix my life today. I'm not going to try to get rid of stress forever. I'm not going to try to get rid of any feelings of loneliness or anger forever. I'm simply going to ask myself, what can I do right now that I've seen in the past makes me feel good about myself after I do it? Sometimes it's something as simple as exercising or treating ourselves to something that doesn't bring up remorse, meditating, calling up somebody that does give us love and acceptance. Most important tools to pick up are what the Buddha called the Brahma Viharas, which are the divine attitudes that are always skillful. And if we plant them when we're next undergoing stress, they'll be there, these positive, skillful voices. And if we listen and we pause and we relax, we'll be able to have alternative solutions to whatever stresses and tensions we're going through. These are the attitudes we practice at the end meditation here, which is wishing ourselves to develop inner peace, peace that's not contingent upon escaping or avoiding or trying to accumulate, by simply instead turning towards what's going on and embracing it and developing calm within. This is metta. The second is developing compassion for ourselves, the sense that we deserve to be free from unnecessary stress and suffering. We deserve to find a form of calmness. Just like any other being, we deserve to find happiness. This is, may I be free of unnecessary stress, suffering, and fear. We just plant these thoughts in the meditation. May I find lasting peace. May I be free from unnecessary stress, suffering, and fear. May I live with ease with no matter what arises. The third is to appreciate the skillful happiness that others achieve, the skillful results of people's actions, the skillful things that we've done, gratitude. May I appreciate everything that I've accomplished skillfully, and may I appreciate the happiness that others achieve. And finally, there's the wisdom that we can't fix everything all at once. That no matter how much we want to get better and not undertake self-sabotaging actions, we will occasionally fall back into ingrained habits. This is the effect of karma. It's like what basic neuroscience, that we've got these tendencies, they're ingrained. Sometimes they'll be too powerful, and we won't be able to escape. Sometimes we'll want to help other people, and we won't be able to help them because of their own karma. This is summarized by the Buddha with the saying, I am the heir to all of my actions, to all that I've done, good or bad, to those actions I fall heir. It simply means that everything we've done will play a part in planting the urges that we experience. If we calm ourselves and relax ourselves, we might develop the ability to choose and to follow more skillful voices. But sometimes they'll be so overwhelming, the stresses, that we'll be pushed to act out. And if that's the case, we don't add more stress. We greet ourselves with compassion. We appreciate the skillful things we've done in life. We take care of ourselves. We prioritize where we can bring comfort right now. And over time, what feels like it's broken and damaged is no longer broken and damaged. We become healed. It's slow. It's gradual. It takes years, but it's a worthwhile practice. So thank you for listening. Even if you were suffering in the heat, I really appreciate your presence. And now...